Hi, this is Dr. Tina Webb, and you are listening to the Coping Season Podcast, the show that discusses mental and emotional wellness to help Black men and Black women begin to heal and cope with the effects of emotional distress. Although I am a licensed clinical social worker, please note that this podcast is not meant to be used as a substitute for a relationship with a licensed therapist. Get ready to laugh, think, and be entertained. It's time to cope. Let's get started. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I am so glad to be back with you all again. And we got a lot to talk about today, so let's just get right into it. How many of y'all know Earl Simmons, a.k.a. DMX, a.k.a. Mr.? There was Brenda, Letitia, Linda, Felicia, Don, LaShawn, Inez, and Alicia, Teresa, Monica, Sharon, Nikki, Lisa, Veronica, Karen, Vicky, Cookie, well, I met her at the ice cream parlor, Tanya, Diane, Lori, and Carla, Marina, Selena, Katrina, Sabrina, about three Kims, what, Latoya, and Tina, Shelly, Bridget, Cavi, Rashida, Kelly, Nicole, Angel, Juanita, Stacy, Tracy, Rana, and Rhonda, Donna, Yolanda, Tawana, and Wanda, what? Y'all know I'm silly and I had to do it. I love me some DMX, and it was such a pleasure. I really enjoyed watching him on the Verses. He did the Verses a couple months ago with Snoop Dogg on Instagram. So it was really good just to hear all of that great music that he's made over the years. He is definitely one of my top favorite rappers of all time and one of the best to ever do it. But as some of you may know, there have been years where we hadn't heard music from DMX, or we hadn't even seen DMX. We hadn't heard music from him. We hadn't seen any appearances from him. And that is because he has been having a long battle with drugs and legal issues over the years. DMX has faced a lot of hardships and a lot of struggles in his life, and he's been very vocal about his battle with substance use and addiction for years. Now, a couple of months ago, DMX did an interview on Talib Kweli's podcast where he shared a heartbreaking story about how he was introduced to drugs by somebody that he trusted. He shared an emotional story about how he was tricked into smoking crack at the age of 14 by his rap mentor. He shared how he didn't smoke weed, he didn't drink or do anything back then. He was just about getting money. Well, you know, he was out robbing and doing stuff, getting money, but he didn't smoke, he didn't drink, he didn't care about it. So one night after they had got a whole bunch of money, they were all celebrating and having a good time, his mentor passed him a blunt. He went ahead and smoked it for the first time. He smoked a blunt, but the blunt was laced with crack. So the same person that introduced him to hip hop also introduced him to crack. Now, during the interview, DMX broke down and he thought about how that moment changed his life and how he considers himself to be blessed with a curse. During the 80s, you have to understand the crack epidemic, it was taking over the cities. All of the major cities, the inner cities, it just ravaged the cities all across the United States. And New York was hit very hard. Now, DMX is from New York. And as a teenager, he was aspiring to be a rapper. He looked up to this local rapper named Reddy Ron. And he said that he saw him as like an older brother. DMX looked up to him, saw him as an older brother. And when DMX was a kid, he used to beatbox and Reddy Ron used to rap over the beatboxing that DMX would do. And he also encouraged DMX to write verses. And he was the one who gave DMH like the encouragement and just the stamp of approval, telling him that his rhymes were good and to just keep going with it, you know. So on one hand, DMX gives this guy credit for introducing him to the rap game because that was like what changed his life. But at the same time, the guy introduced him to crack, which also changed his life. So he views the connection as a blessing and a curse at the same time. Because that single moment led to the beginning of his crack addiction. When he was 14 years old, this grown man that he looked up to, his mentor, handed him a crack-laced blunt and didn't even tell him what he was smoking. DMX said, and I quote, "He passed the blunt around and I hit the blunt. I never felt like this before and it effed me up. I later found out that he laced the blunt with crack. Why would you do that to a child? He was like 30 and he knew I looked up to him. Why would you do that to someone who looks up to you?" And that's what DMX had to say. You know, it's just very sad. It is a very, very sad situation. And it's happened to so many people, how one moment can change the rest of your life. Someone can put something in your drink, or they can lace the weed with something. And it can change everything. DMX's story has been a story of rags to riches. He made it. He became very successful. He was able to pull himself out of poverty and just uplift his friends and everyone around him. He made it, you know, not just as a rapper, but an actor too. DMX came out with a whole bunch of good movies, but because of trauma, substance abuse, addiction, depression, and so much more that's followed him along the way, he has had so many career and personal setbacks because of his drug addiction. He lost his family, his wife and children, his money, opportunities. You know, he's been in and out of jail numerous times for drug possession and for violating his parole. And he almost died in 2016 from a drug overdose. He was found unconscious in the parking lot of the Ramada Inn or something, and police officers, they found him and he wasn't breathing. He didn't have a pulse. So the police had to revive him with CPR and they had to administer Narcan. You know, that's the shot that you give somebody when they overdose, and that can kind of counteract the narcotic overdose. So they had to do that for him, and that kind of brought him back to life. So he's been just through a lot as a result of his addiction. He has been in and out of rehab as well. It's just something that has had a hold on him for a long time, and he's not the only one. On today's segment of Ask Dr. Tina, I want to read a quote from DMX regarding his addiction and sobriety. He stated, and I quote, "Drugs were never a problem. Drugs were a symptom of a bigger problem. There were things I went through in my childhood where I just blocked it out. But there's only so much you can block out, you know, before you run out of space. And then you never know when the things you store away is going to come out and just fall all over the place. It probably won't be a pretty situation. So I learned that I had to deal with the things that hurt me that I didn't deal with when they hurt. When they happened, I didn't deal with them then. It's like, you know what? Let me open this door and start dealing with this S now before it comes out at the wrong time. And I just have a meltdown and I'll be no more good to anybody. So that's what helped with my addiction and sobriety, and just let some of this stuff out. I really didn't have anybody to talk to about it, because, you know, in the hood, nobody wants to hear it. Nobody even wants to help with talking, because so often talking about your problems is a sign of weakness, when it's actually one of the bravest things you can do. One of the bravest things you can do is put it on the table and chop it up and let it out. It has to be to the right person. It has to be with the right person. It's true strength. It comes with understanding that there's a problem. When I started storing these things at such a young age, it was a blessing. It was a gift that God gave me to get past the difficult situations without me having to lose my mind up in here. And that's what DMX had to say. Y'all gonna make me lose my mind up in here. And he is not the only one who feels this way. He is not the only one who has gone through this up and down roller coaster with addiction and recovery. You know, if you or someone you know has struggled with substance use or addiction, then you know how hard it is. You know that the road to recovery is not easy. It can be very long. It can be a very difficult road, sprinkled with relapses all along the way. We all have been affected in one way or another. Maybe you have family members, or you have friends, someone you know who is struggling with drug use or addiction, or you, or someone you know has sold drugs, or they sell drugs, or they've gone to prison for using or selling drugs. We've all been affected in some way. Our communities and families have been torn apart from drugs and alcohol. We all know how the crack epidemic ravished our communities and our families, and we're still seeing the effects of it. There's a new Netflix documentary out too right now, and it's called Crack. I highly recommend you watching it. if you want to understand better about what happened to the Black communities, the war on drugs, and how the government allowed cocaine into America and why they allowed it to happen. So that is a very good documentary to watch. It's called Crack. It's on Netflix, and it just came out in January. So check it out so you can learn a little bit more. You can also check out episode 7 of the podcast, where I talk about it a little bit in episode 7. Now, you know, from the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s to, you know, the war on drugs to today's opioid epidemic, addiction has greatly affected the Black population of the United States. And I'm not saying that Black people use drugs more than other ethnicities, because we all know that that's not true. Statistics show that white people use drugs more. It's just more exaggerated and stereotyped that Black people struggle with addiction more. Now, today, there is an opioid epidemic, and it's affecting millions of Americans. In the last few years, there has been like this alarming increase in the number of opioid related overdoses where white people are dying in rural and suburban communities all across the United States. And so they've been considered the face of this epidemic. However, Black people are dying as well. Black people are overdosing, and they're dying at alarming rates as a result of opioids. It's an urgent issue in our community that's not even being addressed. People aren't talking about it. People are dying from mixing fentanyl into cocaine, mixing fentanyl into heroin. It's important to know that Black people are more likely to use cocaine these days than white people, and therefore, they are fatally overdosing at an 80% higher rate. And that's because Black people are maybe they're using cocaine and it's being cut with fentanyl. So no one's noticing. They're not reporting on this because tens of thousands of people, mostly white people, are dying from the larger opioid epidemic. Fentanyl is 50 times to 100 times more potent than heroin. In the past, people would mix heroin and cocaine. Now, some of the people who were used to that mix, they were used to it, they could handle it. Now they're getting fentanyl and cocaine, and they're dropping dead because their body is not used to the effects of such a powerful opioid like fentanyl. And it's a shock to their whole system. And the crisis is growing as more people start to use cocaine. And in the Black community, we're using cocaine, like I said, more than white people. Black people have been dying at a higher rate from cocaine-related overdoses than people of other races. In 2018, 2 million Americans use cocaine on a regular basis, and Black people use it at a rate of 40% higher than white people. And this is important because we tend to suffer from more serious health and psychosocial problems like drug-related illnesses, accidents and injuries because of the drugs, exposure to violence, legal problems. We're exposed to more communicable diseases such as HIV and AIDS. You know, we have to deal with stigma. We have to deal with untreated mental health issues. There is just so much that comes along with our substance use. But unfortunately, the impact of the epidemic in Black communities, it's going unrecognized. The social and political attention around this opioid epidemic is focusing more on the overdose deaths of white, middle-class, suburban users. And even though the rates of opioid use at a national level is higher for white people than it is for Black people, the rates in the increase of opioid deaths has been rising among Black people as well. And then with this COVID-19 pandemic, on top of the opioid pandemic, on top of people dying from all of these overdoses, people dying from COVID, people unemployed, people stressed out, it's a lot going on. And that is making it even more challenging to get people into treatment and into recovery. So on today's episode, I want to take a deeper dive into opioid addiction in the Black community. It's important to know that when we talk about opioids, we're talking about narcotics. You can buy them on the street, or you can get them prescribed by your doctor to help with pain relief. So we're talking about oxycodone. That's the OxyContin, Oxy, Percocet, Percodan, Roxette, Indocet, all of those. And then On the other side, we're talking about hydrocodone, which is the Vicodin, the Norco, the Nortab, Lorset, and the Vicoprofen. And then you have the codeines that's found in like medications like Tylenol number 3 or Robitussin AC and other opioids like hydromorphone, which is also diluted. And then you have morphine, which is also, you know, it comes in the name, aka MS Contin and Roxanol. And those are all strong prescription pain medications. And sometimes you can find those medications in pills that have acetaminophen, like Tylenol. Acetaminophen is basically Tylenol. And that's why when you go to CVS and Rite Aid, they have some of those Tylenols and other medications locked up, or you have to get it from the pharmacist and you can't just get it yourself because people are using it for abuse. And then you have fentanyl, aka Sublimaze, Sub-C's, Duergesic, and China White is what it's called. And some of these names I may be saying wrong, so just bear with me, you guys. The thing to know about fentanyl is that it is a synthetic opioid. So it's used to treat like severe pain, especially when someone has advanced cancer pain. So that's what they normally use fentanyl for. And it is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. So fentanyl, you can get it prescribed by a doctor, but then also you can buy it on the street, and it's being sold, it's being made illegally on the street, and it's being sold in the drug markets because fentanyl has like the effect of heroin. And oftentimes people will mix, they're mixing fentanyl with the heroin, they're mixing fentanyl with cocaine, or they're pressing fentanyl into counterfeit prescription pills. So you look like you're getting Norco or you're getting something or whatever, but they're putting fentanyl into those pills and selling them on the street. And the thing with fentanyl that is so dangerous is that a tiny amount can kill you. A tiny amount can cause a fatal overdose. Now, another opioid is methadone, aka Dolphin, which is that's a long acting prescription opioid, and it's sometimes used to treat opioid addiction. So, you know, that's something that people can abuse as well. And then lastly, you have heroin, which is aka black tar. Heroin is called dope. It's called junk. It's called smack, and probably a whole bunch of other names that I don't know of. But heroin is an opioid, and it's not used medically like the pills that we mentioned. But you can buy heroin on the street, and people inject it with a needle into their veins, into their body. They smoke it. They snort it. And like I said, heroin is sometimes contaminated with fentanyl and other very potent drugs. And that increases the risk of accidental overdose and death. And that's why people are dying. They do not know what they're getting. So much stuff is being mixed into these drugs these days. So, you know, it's important to know that opioids are very highly addictive. And all of these drugs that I mentioned, the ones you get from your doctor, the ones you buy on the street, all of them can be deadly. People are overdosing left and right. And even though there's been like a significant increase in the number of opioid related overdose deaths in black communities, the media portrays this epidemic as white. It is a white, rural, suburban crisis. And because of that, intervention strategies and policies, they're not being used to address the severity of the problem in black communities, and they're not offering culturally sensitive, like preventative and treatment solutions to help our community. You know, during the crack epidemic, the face of that epidemic was black people. And when the focus was on black people, the policies, the government, the treatment programs, all of that stuff, nothing was being done to help black people overcome the addiction. The focus was on criminalizing black people for having an addiction. Now, with the opioid addiction, the face of it is white people, and they're not criminalizing them. They're taking an approach of helping them through programs and medical avenues and treatment facilities and stuff like that. It's being viewed as a national public health crisis, and they're taking like a health approach to the problem. And Black people are being excluded from that help because it's not even being acknowledged that opioid addiction is an issue in the Black community. It's like no one started caring until white people started dying. So this is just another example of racial inequity, institutional and structural racism. There is a lot of money being put into solving this issue of the opioid epidemic. There is a lot of federal and state funding for prevention and treatment and recovery programs. But like I said, attention to this epidemic has focused primarily on white, suburban, rural communities, and less attention has been focused on Black communities, which are also experiencing a lot of overdose and just a dramatic increase in opioid misuse and a lot of deaths. And because of the history and the criminalization of Black people due to cocaine addiction in the 1980s and the 90s, there is a mistrust of law enforcement and public health efforts. There's resentment in the Black community as a result of how we were treated and how we were locked away in prisons as a result of race-based policies and basically racism. Cocaine and crack cocaine, they're dangerous, addictive drugs, just like opioids are. You know, cocaine and crack can lead to a lot of serious health conditions like sudden cardiac death, brain seizures, heart attack, and stroke, and so many other things. But you would think that something like this that causes all these health issues would be treated with a health approach. But it was treated as a crime and not an addiction that deserved medical treatment. You know, because of racial profiling and because of cultural stereotypes, historically, Black people have been plagued with problems of drugs. So when it comes down to try to help the Black community today with opioids, there's a lot of barriers and a lot of challenges because it's like you didn't care back when crack was destroying us and our communities. So why do you care now? Why are you trying to help us now? And people feel like that because for over 30 years, the disease model of addiction, it's always been around. That was around during the crack epidemic, but they didn't implement it when crack was affecting the Black community. Now, though, they're using it as a guide to help with this opioid pandemic, or what they call it, epidemic. And it's been long said for a long time that addicts should be in treatment and not in prison. They were saying that back then, but no one was listening. During the crack epidemic and the war on drugs, they looked to the criminal justice system to solve the problem instead of the medical system. So instead of treatment, they focused on increasing law enforcement personnel. They've focused on expanding the prisons. But now, since white people make up about 80% of opioid overdose deaths, they want to change their approach to addressing the problem. Now that the problem isn't just affecting poor Black and Hispanic people, they want to change their approach to a more therapeutic approach. And it feels like a slap in the face to minority communities. Because where was our compassion and understanding? This is just, unfortunately, another example of white privilege. And it adds to the racial trauma that everyone else has to deal with. It's the idea that white people addicted to drugs are perceived as victims in need of treatment, and Black people addicted to drugs are perceived as criminals and we're sent to jail. It's so tragic and it's so hurtful. But the truth is, race should not matter. Addiction is a devastating disease, no matter what racial, no matter what gender, no matter what socioeconomic group you're in. Addiction ruins the lives of people and families every single day from every single walk of life. And it is equally as tragic, regardless of what color you are, regardless of where you live, regardless of whether you get your drug from a dealer or from a doctor. This current opioid epidemic is one of the largest drug epidemics recorded in United States history. We are in a drug overdose epidemic, y'all. Approximately 130 people or more die each day to an opioid-related overdose. And that's just from opioids. We're not even counting all of the other drugs that are not opioids that people are using and overdosing on, like, you know, crystal methamphetamine, GHB and analogs, inhalants, Jimson weed, ketamine, cot, or cat, LSD, MDMA, marijuana, methamphetamine, PCP, powdered cocaine, prescription drugs, yaba, and so many more, bath salts and all these things. But we're talking about opioids and focused on opioids because a lot of people are overdosing and dying very frequently because of opioids. And when we talk about drug overdose from opioids, there is a large increase in overdose deaths that involve synthetic opioids like fentanyl, fentanyl analogs, and tramadol. According to the DEA, to the Drug Enforcement Agency, Colombia is producing a lot of cocaine. They're producing so much cocaine that the prices are lower, and that makes it easier to get. And you know, cocaine has been around forever. It's never gone away. People have always been using it. But what's different about cocaine is that they're intentionally and unintentionally adding fentanyl to it. Fentanyl is cheap. It's not expensive. So sometimes the dealers, they'll spike the cocaine to try to get people hooked on it. And then other times, some of the fentanyl, it gets mixed in into the cocaine just because they're being sloppy with the way that they're doing it. They're not handling it right. You know, somewhere within like them packaging it, some fentanyl may have gotten into it somewhere along the way. So it gets in there on accident too. Now, people who use cocaine, they don't see themselves as opioid users because they're not seeking opioids. They're seeking cocaine. They think they're getting cocaine and they don't realize that they're getting fentanyl too. Now, people who use heroin, people who abuse like opioid pills, they know what opioids can do. So they carry around with them, you know, the opioid overdose reversal drug, the Narcan, like I told you that DMX had to get the shot. It's also naloxone. So they'll carry that around with them to reverse the overdose and save their lives. And that just makes them feel invisible. So now it's like, I can do these drugs and I can still survive because I have my naloxone. I have my Narcan. And it comes in the form of a syringe. You can inject the medication, and it also comes as a nasal spray. So people who use opioids, they might have those on them. But someone who uses cocaine, they're not going to have Narcan on them. They're not going to have naloxone with them. So when they get cocaine mixed with fentanyl, they might overdose and just die, and that's it. And then there are some people who know what they're getting. They know that they're getting cocaine with fentanyl, but because they've become addicted to that type of potent high, they have to keep on getting it because of the addiction. Even though the danger is there that their next hit might kill them, they are still seeking it. You know, using cocaine these days is just so much more dangerous because you really don't know what's in it. You might take it and get super high, and then the next time you take it, you might die. Because first of all, the drug dealers, they are not scientists. They are not chemists. They don't know what they're doing. They're just mixing stuff. And because they're just mixing stuff, you got to be careful. A lot of people who've had dealers for years, they kind of trust the dealer because they haven't died or they hadn't had like any adverse effects. So they trust the dealer and they trust that they're getting what the dealer says that they're giving them. But what's happening today is that these dealers are cutting the cocaine with fentanyl and they're killing their long-standing customers. So it's just a very dangerous situation out there. It's also important to know that there is no treatment for cocaine addiction. There's no medications to treat cocaine addiction. Like when people are hooked on opioids, there's medication to treat that. They can use Suboxone and methadone. But when people are hooked on cocaine, they can just go to therapy or NA meetings. So a lot of Black people may be hooked on opioids and they don't even know because to them, they're just using cocaine, not realizing the dangers of today's cocaine. It's not just cocaine. It's not just cocaine and heroin. It's something way more deadly. It's fentanyl. And I'm bringing cocaine up because Black people, especially in urban areas, they've been associated with higher rates of cocaine use and selling cocaine, crack cocaine. And even though the trend has gone down like since the 90s, Black people are twice as likely than other racial groups to report having a cocaine problem when they go into substance abuse treatment. Now, besides the fentanyl mixed with the cocaine or the heroin and the cocaine, Black people are getting addicted to opioids because they're going to the doctor and they're getting prescribed pain medications. Now, some doctors, they will overprescribe some of these pills. People end up getting addicted. And then they also end up buying them from other people, from family members or from friends or on the street, because they get dependent on them. And eventually, after they take the pills for so long, they eventually graduate to using heroin because heroin is a little bit cheaper and it's easier to get. Now, another way that people are getting addicted to the opioids, like I said, is through using heroin and cocaine, which has been used historically in low-income Black communities since like the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. But what's different now is that the cocaine and the heroin together are being laced with fentanyl, and that makes it even more dangerous. It's killing people. They're overdosing. When it comes down to prescription drugs, Black people, we're not getting them as easy as white people do, because medical professionals oftentimes stereotype Black people. They can be very biased and they have a lot of misperceptions about Black people that dates back to slavery. The idea that we can tolerate pain more than white people, so we don't need medication. When we complain about pain, our pain is dismissed. When we say we're in pain, we're not heard. And because of stereotypes like, you know, Black people abuse drugs more than other people, Black people are less likely to even get an opioid prescription. We don't have access to those type of pain medications. We won't get prescribed opioids for our pain. They'll give us something else. Studies show that as Black people, we are more likely to experience miscommunication or misinterpretation about our pain with our medical providers. They believe we experience less pain than white people and that we are drug seekers. So they underprescribe medications to us. They don't overprescribe to us. They underprescribe. So because Black people have lower access to prescription opioids, there's this false belief being put out there that Black people are being protected from the opioid crisis and we're not affected by the opioid crisis. And that's not true. You know, prescription opioids like morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, or codeine, those are being contributed to a large number of the opioid overdoses. Now, when we look back at the history of addressing substance abuse in the Black community and substance use in the Black community, we can go back to the temperance movement, like to prohibition and all of that. We can go all the way back to the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Black people, you know, a lot of people were promoting abstinence during that time. Black people started promoting it too. They were being abstinent against drinking alcohol. And that was a way to address like the substance use and the impacts on health and on well-being and on the families. Now, temperance, that was a social movement in the late 1800s and the early 1900s against the consumption of alcohol. Now, people who were part of the movement, they promoted like cutting back on the alcohol, and a lot of them promoted just complete abstinence from alcohol because of the negative impact, like I said, on health, on our lives, on our families. Now, you know, even when we think of Black people who were part of the movement, Frederick Douglass, he was a leading advocate of the temperance movement. And, you know, in addition to his efforts to help abolish slavery in the 1800s, you know, slave masters, they used to have drinking contests for the slaves and get them drunk and have them drinking and, you know, for their entertainment to watch this. And Frederick Douglass, he saw this as a means. Alcohol was a mean for the slave masters to control Black people, another way to use us or to control us. So he viewed sobriety as a key strategy in the emancipation and in the full citizenship of Black people. So he considered drinking alcohol a danger to the Black man's survival. And then you have W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, he was also an early supporter of the temperance. He saw it as a strategy for self-development, like for us to abstain from alcohol and stay away from alcohol and just putting that in our body so that, you know, we can improve our self-development within the Black community and be more productive and, you know, move forward. He later became critical of the movement because He later saw that it was being used as a tool for social oppression and another way to control Black people. So, you know, that's just the history. There are so many people who came along and tried to talk about substance use and prevention in the Black community, dating all the way back to the 1800s, the 1900s, the 70s, the 60s. You know, in 1978, a book came out called I'm Black and I'm Sober. It was written by Chaney Allen, and it was one of the first autobiographies of an African-American in recovery. And then you have Dr. Benny Prim. He did so many great things to address addiction. Dr. Benny Prim, he helped to found the Addiction Research Treatment Corporation in 1969, and that is located in Brooklyn, New York. And it's one of the largest minority nonprofit community-based substance abuse treatment programs in the country, in the entire United States. And you know, Dr. Benny Prim, he also helped to bring about like the medication assisted treatment for opioid addiction, like for them to start using the Suboxone and the methadone. You know, he passed away in 2015, but he has just been a leader within the American Association for Treatment of Opioid Dependence. He even served as a consultant to four different presidents of the United States on substance abuse and public health issues. He was also the first director of the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And, you know, he's just done so much with addiction. He's also served as a U.S. representative on issues of drug addiction and AIDS to the World Health Organization in Geneva, and just so much more. So many great things that he's done to try to help address addiction and recovery in the Black community. So as you see, we have always tried to keep drugs out of the Black community. We have always tried to work on getting treatment for those affected by drugs and alcohol in the Black community. We have always tried to help ourselves, despite the false narratives and stereotypes that the media and the government tries to spin about Black people and drug addiction. There are just so many negative representations and stereotypes and stigma when it comes down to being Black and having a substance use disorder. Because of the negative images that portray Black people who have a substance use disorder, there is a lot of mistreatment. There's a lot of discrimination. There is a lot of harsh punishment that Black people have to face. We have to face all of that in the Black community. Instead of giving us treatment and giving us recovery services that we need, we are stigmatized. We are incarcerated. And it's even hard to talk about the opioid crisis in the Black community because we don't want to hear the words crisis or epidemic associated with the Black community, because it makes us fearful that we're going to go to prison, because the media, because of society, because of the government, they're going to point their attention to us and they're going to lock us up like they've always done. That's the fear. And all of these false narratives and stereotypes about Black people and drug use have historically been used as an opportunity to put us in prison. But where is the narrative that shows opportunities for compassion, understanding, treatment, and recovery for the Black community? And speaking of recovery, because there are so many other barriers, it's not easy for Black people to get help. They may not be able to afford health care. They don't have insurance. They might not be able to get pain management options like detox or rehab or counseling, or, you know, even culturally sensitive approaches that might not be attainable in our community. That's why representation matters. That's why we need more Black physicians, more Black psychiatrists, psychologists, clinical social workers, nurses. It makes a difference in our treatment outcomes. It makes a difference in the quality of care that Black people receive. It's important to know that there are over 2 million people in the United States that are addicted to opioids. Overdose deaths involving prescription opioids have quadrupled, y'all, since 1999. And drug overdoses now kill more people every year than gun violence and car accidents. I don't know if you know this, but more than 750,000 people have died since 1999 from drug overdose. Now, when we look at drug overdoses, you know, say three people overdose, two of those deaths are because of an opioid. So it is just really serious out here. You know, people are dying from the prescription opioids. They're dying from heroin. They're dying from fentanyl. It has increased. The amount of deaths has increased almost six times since 1999. And it's also estimated that over 8,000 people use heroin each year. And I want you to know that we are not just talking about adults using opioids and dying. Kids are dying. Teenagers are dying. Adults are dying. Older people are dying. 12-year-olds, 10-year-olds, they're dying from opioid use. They are misusing opioids. They're popping pills. They're listening to these songs and they're doing the dang thing. And they are dying. In 2018, do you know that there were 10 million people aged 12 or older who misused opioids that year? And most of them are misusing the prescription pain relievers. And then for people who are injecting opioids, when they inject opioids, that adds to a whole bunch of other problems, and it puts them at risk of contracting HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. Studies show that people who inject drugs, they make up 9% of HIV diagnoses. And you know, I know I talked a lot about the fentanyl in the Black community and the cocaine, but a lot of people are also overdosing from prescription opioids like morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and codeine in the Black communities. You know, a lot of people are drinking lean in the Black community and putting codeine in it and all kind of other stuff, and they are overdosing and they're dying. And a lot of pharmaceutical companies too, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of them are getting sued. They've been getting sued over the years because they marketed these drugs, these prescription medications. You know, they want the doctors to use their product. And so they market the drugs to doctors and they're telling them that, you know, oh, this product is safe. It doesn't form habits and all of these different things. And they understate the fact that the medications can be very addictive. And you know, doctors and different people started suing them. So now you have pharmaceutical companies, they are reformulating some of the drugs, like, you know, Purdue Pharma, they make the OxyContin. And so what they've done is they started making the OxyContin harder to crush so that people can't snort the pills. So they did that as a way to try to stop people from abusing OxyContin, from snorting it, from crushing the pills and doing that. And it did work for a little while. Some of the overdoses from OxyContin, it did decrease. But what ended up happening is people started using heroin instead. And then there was another problem. There was a whole bunch of heroin overdoses and a lot more cases of hepatitis C because people started using contaminated needles. So there were just a lot of different unintended consequences that came as a result of them reformulating OxyContin. Now, something else that I want to touch on is substance use and mental health. You know, because so much attention is being given to white people when it comes down to this epidemic, Black people are being overlooked and we're not getting the help and the resources that we need. You know, it's not easy to find culturally sensitive rehab programs and other mental health treatment programs for Black people. And that's important because most of the time we're not just dealing with substance use. We are dealing with mental health as well. Black people are 20% more likely than the rest of the United States population to experience severe forms of mental illness like depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, ADHD, higher rates of suicide among Black men. You know, it's just a lot of different things. We're not just treating cocaine and fentanyl. We're treating cocaine and the opioid addiction along with PTSD. And on top of that, you got, I'm feeling suicidal and I'm feeling depressed and all of these different things. You know, when mental illness is combined with substance abuse, it becomes even harder to find treatment. Substance abuse it makes the symptoms of a mental illness, it can make it worse. So, and it makes it more difficult oftentimes for mental health professionals to be able to diagnose some of the serious psychiatric conditions like depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia, because the person is using the drugs and you don't know if they're acting that way because of the drugs or because of the mental illness. So, you know, it's called a co-occurring disorder when someone is dealing with mental illness and substance abuse. Unfortunately, in the Black community and in many communities, not just Black, substance abuse or drug use or misuse is something that's often passed down from generation to generation. In some cases, you know, the whole family might be dealing with addiction. Everybody is using drugs. Grandma is using, you know, her son or daughter is using drugs. And then her, you know, her grandkids are using drugs and so on and so on. And in families, sometimes they're all using opioids and other substances together. Like they're using alcohol, they're using weed, they're using other drugs together within the family, and they're all getting high together, especially in communities with high poverty and unemployment. Unfortunately, intergenerational polysubstance abuse is not uncommon in the Black community. And not only are we using it, we're selling it. We're selling pills, selling cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and all kinds of stuff, because oftentimes we live in poor, low-income communities, and selling drugs is a way to get money. It's a way to survive. Now, I am not condoning selling drugs to our community, to our families, to people. I'm not condoning that. I'm not saying that that makes it okay because they're poor and low income. I'm just stating the reality of what's happening, the reality of what's happening in the lives of people in the Black community. And I guess I can clarify that even further. I'm not talking about the lives of Black people in the Black community. I'm talking about the lives of some Black people in the Black community, because not everybody is using drugs. Not everybody is selling drugs. People have jobs and they're making it happen out here. So I just want to put that out there. Now, as far as seeking help, that's a touchy subject as well, because there's fear. There is this history of Black people being arrested, being torn from our hospital beds after giving birth, and being taken to prison because of substance use. In the Black community, there is a history of mistrust of healthcare professionals, of the healthcare system, of social services, of the justice system, and rightfully so. We have a reason to mistrust and to not trust, especially for Black men. There is still a fear that if we seek treatment, we might have to face some kind of severe consequence. Like, you know, we cannot trust that you're not going to report me, or you're not going to do something that's going to impact my life even more. You know, I'm trying to come clean. I'm trying to get the help. But there is still a fear that, okay, I might get some kind of harsh sentence or incarceration. You know, they might take away my kids. You know, all of these different fears that come up. So we keep it to ourselves and we suffer in silence. We suffer and we destroy ourselves. We destroy our families. We destroy our communities instead of acknowledging that we have a problem and go get help. You know, and we see it in the life of DMX. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how much celebrity you have. If you're Black and you're using drugs, you are often stigmatized. Look how many times DMX went to jail because of drugs. How many times did he go to treatment? How many times did he go to jail when he could have went to treatment instead? But, you know, this is just what we have to face, and this is what needs to change. You know, it's important to know that substance use disorder or drug addiction, it's a disease. That's important to know, because in the Black community, we hide our addiction because it's seen as a sign of weakness, not a disease. You're seen as not strong. You're seen as having a weak mind because you couldn't say no to drugs. And I think that that's very important to talk about, because we can't be just judging people. Judging people isn't going to make them stop using the drug or shame them into doing something different. That's just going to make them hide what they're doing. And when they hide what they're doing, everybody is affected. They'll never get the help. They'll get the help way down the line after they've cause so much destruction in their lives and the lives of other people. So we got to stop hiding it and just look at it. This is a disease. This is an addiction, something that you need medical treatment and you need help to try to overcome. You need support. You know, people use drugs for different reasons. We don't know what might have happened in the person's life that led them to drugs. Some people use drugs one time and it might be laced with something, you know, and that can happen to anybody. Somebody can bring you a drink and you don't know what's in it. Somebody could give you a cigarette and maybe they sprinkle some cocaine in there or something and you don't know. So there's just a lot of things that can happen. Sometimes people will try drugs for the first time. They try something for the first time and they get hooked on it right after the first hit. And then after that, it's hard to get that monkey off their back. But it's not impossible. There are so many people who have overcome their substance use. There are so many people who have gotten well. Like I say, it is never too late to be well. Once a person makes a decision that, hey, you know what? I don't want to live like this no more. I'm going to go ahead and try to confront and overcome these things that led me to start using and abusing these drugs from the jump. Like all of those negative emotions, all of that stress, negative relationships, you know, peer pressure, past trauma, mental illness, whatever it is, whatever they're covering up with their drug use or whatever they're using those drugs to try to help them cope with, once they start to address it, life gets better. They get better. You know, everyone is different. Everyone's story of addiction is different. The journey towards healing and recovery is going to be different. It's going to be different for everyone. Everything is not going to work for everybody. And that's okay, because you can always find something that's going to work best for you and your recovery. Let me tell you how. You know what time it is. It's time to cope. It's time to pull out our coping toolboxes. I'm going to give us some tools to toss in there today to help us cope with substance use disorder. Addiction, y'all. Opioid addiction, whatever addiction you are dealing with, I'm going to give you some tools to cope with it. Remember, we're going to be building this coping toolbox every time that we're together so that we can keep everything that we need that can calm us during times of distress and help us to express how we feel in healthy ways. The first thing that I want you to know is that if you're in the recovery process or you're supporting someone who is a recovering addict, it's going to be important to have certain coping skills to help overcome what you're going through. So the first thing I would say is think before you act. Just be aware, and I want you to practice waiting before you respond to something that's happened to you. Take a breath. When something stressful happens, take a moment, sit back. Take a deep breath, clear your mind, take a few breaths. You know, you want to make sure that you have a level head before you make a decision. Oftentimes, when we rush into decisions or we give an answer quickly, we end up doing irrational things. We end up doing irrational actions. So you want to stop and think about it first. Now, y'all know I'm always talking about mindfulness. I'm always talking about meditation. And I pretty much say it at the end. I put that in the coping toolbox every time. And that's because it works. Mindfulness and meditation techniques is what's going to help you to work through some of those difficult thoughts and emotions so you can stay focused on the here and now. You can stay in the present. It's important for people in recovery also to keep busy. You want to keep busy because in the past, when a person was addicted to drugs, they probably spent a lot of their time focused on the drug and the drug activities. They probably spend a lot of time trying to get drugs, using drugs, or recovering from drugs, selling drugs, all kinds of things that revolve around drugs. So now that they're in this place of being sober, you have to learn how to replace those old habits with new habits, with positive habits. So it's important to make like a to-do list, plan out your day, start checking off things off your list, clean your closet, clean your trunk, clean your garage, help somebody do something. You know, you can build something. Do some of the things you've been putting off, you know, binge and watch some TV, dance, sing, learn how to play an instrument, learn how to make beats or music and read books. do whatever makes you feel good outside of doing drugs. You know, you want to get to a place too where you're being healthy and you're taking care of your physical health, your mental health. So it's really important when you're in recovery to eat healthy, to try to do some exercise, because when people use drugs, the drugs can take a toll on your body. It takes a toll on your physical health, your mental health. So it's important just to exercise, eat nutritious and healthy meals, take vitamins, drink a lot of water, get rid of those toxins and those chemicals in the body that came from drug use, you know, and then try to get yourself to a place where you feel good. And then that can help lessen those feelings too of anxiety, of stress, of depression, of low confidence, low motivation, all of that. So very important to just maintain your health. And then journaling, as usual. Journaling is very powerful, y'all. When someone is in recovery, instead of holding on to all of those feelings and those fears and those thoughts and those demons come out and are building up inside, write it down. Get it out of you and put it on some paper so that you can see it and you can help to work through some of the things that you might be struggling with. And also talking to a therapist can help. Getting therapy, having a sponsor, having support, having someone that you can talk to can help keep a person from relapsing, because you have somebody to work through some of those negative thoughts and feelings and those cravings together. So it's going to be important to have support, to have people that you can call when you need to talk, and not those old friends that, you know, you would use drugs with and go seek drugs and all of that stuff. No, you got to be around some new people, people that you can trust that aren't going to take you back down that path. So it's important also sometimes to just join some of the 12-step meetings, the Narcotics Anonymous, the AA meetings, you know, start going to group therapy. All of that can help and can help to build support. And then practicing gratitude can help. Just think of everything that you've had to come out of. When people get into recovery, that is a long journey sometimes. And it's something that is not easy for a lot of people. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. People wouldn't have a drug addiction or a substance use disorder. They'd be able to stop whenever they wanted to. But it's not like that. If you've come out of it and you are in recovery, or someone you know is in recovery right now, you know, that's something to be grateful for. That is something that was hard work for them. And it's even harder to maintain. You know, if you or someone you care about, a loved one or a friend, is struggling with addiction, don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, when I talk about gratitude too, just be grateful of how far that you've come. And just know that you're not alone. Know that you don't have to go on this journey alone. You know, even if you've burned some bridges along the way, there are new bridges that you can make until you can repair those old ones. You are not alone. There is help. There is support for you. Please do not hesitate to get help. If you or someone you know is struggling with substance use, substance abuse, you know, addiction, drug addiction, all of these words are the same. You know, it's called substance use disorder now, but you still hear people say drug addiction. You hear people say drug misuse, substance use, substance abuse. All of it is to describe drug addiction. So if you or someone you know is struggling, you can call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP. 1-800-662-4357. And that's SAMHSA. So it's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services National Helpline at 1-800-662-4357. And you can call 24/7, 365 days a year. It's free and it's confidential. I just want to say that you can overcome this. You can come out of this. You can do this. If you're already doing it, if you have done it before and you've overcome drug addiction, if you've overcome your substance use, I just want to say congratulations. Keep up the good work. If you're in the process of it and it's hard, I just want to say keep going. get some support, and keep going. You can do this. I want you to remember, you were not born to be enslaved to drugs and alcohol. You were born for a greater purpose, and I cannot wait to see it. I'm glad that you are on this journey. If you're listening to this show right now, something piqued your interest for you to click on it. And I just want to say congratulations, because this is the beginning of your journey right here, just getting the information. Now, someone anonymous once said, and I quote, "What's done is done. What's gone is gone. One of life's lessons is always moving on. It's okay to look back to see how far you've come, but keep moving forward." And on that note, that's all the tools that I got. Go ahead and put those coping toolboxes away, y'all. It's time for one of my favorite parts of the show, movie therapy, music therapy. I would like to dedicate today's episode to the song called "Pills and Potions" by Nicki Minaj. And the song says, "Pills and potions, we're overdosing. I'm angry, but I still love you. Pills and potions, we're overdosing. Can't stand it, but I still love you. I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love. I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love. I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love. I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love, I still love." I believe that. I receive that. And I mean that. It's coping season, y'all. Thank you for joining me this week. I hope you all enjoyed this episode. You are not only listeners, you are my co-hosts, and we are a community. And I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your stories, experiences, and thoughts related to life issues, topics you'd like to hear discussed, or questions you'd like answered. Please visit me on the web at drtinaweb.com and click on Ask Dr. Tina to submit your questions, thoughts, and more. Tune in every Wednesday to hear my response. You can also check out the show notes as well as other contact information on the website. In the meantime and in between time, for additional updates, conversations, and more ways to interact, please connect with me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dr. Tina Webb. That's DrTinaWebb. Feel free to share your thoughts from the show on social media using the hashtag CopingSeasonPodcast. Lastly, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you are listening to help others find the show and learn to cope just like you. I appreciate and read every single review. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for spreading the word to all of your friends, family, and coworkers. I so appreciate it. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.